Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
1 August in the 1970s, when the leaving results were due to come out, the country was holding its breath. And I, a guidance counsellor in Donegal, was very worried. For I'd 3 6-year pupils who hadn't given a hoot throughout the year. Although they'd streeled in from the bus day after day, their faces whipped red by the winds off Errigal. Teresa, Mary Rose and Bernadette. I remember them clearly, their high spirits and shining eyes, their skinny figures swathed in herringbone tweed. All year they'd come into the school together, giggling and teasing, loud in their shouts of, "In under God!" as they told the crack of the previous night when they were pulling pints in the Come On Inn. These lassies were clever indeed, but unruly, knew they could throw school to the wind any day they liked and come back the next, their copybooks tacky with jam, but homework done. And how I worried they'd fail their leaving, for how could they other than fail? Indeed, I suspected they even wanted to fail, but it was hard to tell, for they feared nothing more than to be sent away, maybe as far as the uni in distant Galway. When the results arrived in the school, I scanned them quickly, skipped over the rows of A's and B's of committed scholars to reach the names of the wayward. And my eyes grew wide, for incredibly, those harebrained idle lassies, those wild and windswept children, had passed the exam, had even excelled. As I laid aside the sheaf of results and had fallen to thinking about God's wonderful ways, the phone on my desk rang. "How are you doing, miss?" It was Teresa. Along with her voice, I could hear other muffled sounds like breathing and sniffling and choking, which caused me to ask where exactly she was. "I'm here, miss," she elucidated. "Here in the phone box on Mina Roy. Me and Mary Rose and Bernadette." "The three of you all together?" Ah, now I could understand the stifled giggles and the vague mumbling sounds, and I had to chuckle. For that phone box on the side of Mina Roy was one bleak and lonesome P&T box set in the heather. A remote and desolate box, beacon to many a traveller broken down on those ribbony roads at night. And now the three of them were squashed in there together. The door held tight, but ajar, just enough to let the air in and keep the rain out. And I smiled, for it was obvious why they were phoning. They'd left off their work in the Come On Inn to get their leaving results. Casually, of course, but there'd be courage in numbers. "Well, Teresa, the good news for you." And I paused to register her delight. "You passed, and so did Mary Rose, and so did Bernadette." Then, instead of a cheer, there followed an almost total silence. Only the muffled, shuffling sounds went on, the creaking of a door and the moaning of wind. "Teresa," I called again. "Teresa!" There was no reply, so I shouted, "Can you hear me? Mary Rose? Bernadette?" In the ensuing half-silence, I could see the phone box with its tight-fitting cargo swaying in the gale, and I began to panic. Then came Mary Rose's voice. "Please, miss, it's all right. It's only that Teresa fainted." After that, just some more huffing sounds and the clank of the phone going dead. Now, I was never to find out whether it was excitement or lack of oxygen that caused Teresa to faint that day, or whether in that sweaty phone box she could see uni looming too near. Whatever the reason, I knew her pals would gather her up, and with the leaving certificates safe in their pockets, they'd head for the hills, the pulling of pints, and the dancing. 50 years on, it's a much different Leaving Cert world. Never more so than this year, as students all over the country await their calculated grades tomorrow. But I can't help wondering if those lassies still laugh as they tell anxious grandchildren of how they once got their leaving results in a phone box on the side of Mina Roy.
On my first visit to Istanbul in 1983, I was fascinated to find that myself and my companion were the only European guests in our hotel in the Old City. Everyone else, with the woman particularly distinctive to my young Irish eyes, as they were totally swathed in black, was from Syria or Iraq. Normally, I learned from talking to the hotel manager, these guests wouldn't have been in Istanbul at all. First choice, before war began raging in Lebanon in the late 1970s, had always been Beirut. Beautiful Beirut, the so-called Paris of the Middle East, and once upon a time holiday hotspot for the moneyed Middle Easterners and a plethora of Hollywood stars who wanted to live it up in the Levant. It was the writer Jan Morris who probably described it best. Here's her take on Beirut in the late 1950s. There it stands, with a toss of curls and a flounce of skirts, a Carmen among the cities. The last of the Middle Eastern fleshpots. It's a harbour, a brothel, an observatory on the edge of the Arab deserts. Its origins are ancient, but it burgeons with brash modernity and it lounges upon its delectable shore, in a posture that no such city, at such a latitude, in such a moment of history, has any reasonable excuse for assuming. And now, having survived the mayhem of many years of conflict, having left the ravages of various Lebanese wars behind, and in recent years, having rebuilt its reputation as a modern jewel in the touristic crown of the Middle East, Beirut now lies in ruins once again, following this summer's catastrophic ammonium nitrate explosion. But Beirut was already on my mind weeks before the city's recent devastation, for I was travelling there on a daily basis in the company of one particular man, transported there by the power of his words. Not to the fleshpot city of fun and frolics, as depicted by Jan Morris, but rather to a city riven with conflict and fear, suspicion and revenge. What does the name Beirut say to you? To me, it says Brian Keenan. It's 30 years now since Brian came home from what he has always jokingly referred to as his holidays. 30 years since his release from captivity in late August 1990, after enduring 4.5 horrific years as a hostage at the hands of Islamic Jihad, kidnapped on an April morning in 1986 as he walked to work at the American University in Beirut, where he had been teaching English since the beginning of the year. And to mark that 30-year milestone, I have been rereading Keenan's extraordinary story of those captivity years, his seminal book, An Evil Cradling. I still remember reading it in the early 90s. I'd never read anything quite like it. The power of the writing, the honesty, the fear, the defiance, the courage, the self-awareness, the sheer humanity. It's the only book I've ever read, which once finished, I reopened immediately and started to read all over again. And all these years later, that impact hasn't lessened. From the very first page, you're right there, in the cell and in his head. The mind games, the humour, the humiliation and the despair. It is always difficult to find a beginning, are the wise and honest words with which Brian Keenan opens An Evil Cradling. Wise, mind you, is his middle name. When I tentatively asked him some months ago if he would do a newspaper interview with me to mark the 30th anniversary, he politely said no. He didn't want to parade himself or his family in public. Fame, he once said, is its own kind of prison. How wise he is, therefore, to have learned from that. Meanwhile, Brian Keenan's mind right now is focused not on himself, but rather on the latest tragedy that has befallen what he described to me just last week as his still beleaguered but beloved city. My view of what happened to me more than 30 years ago pales against the tragedy of Beirut today, he told me. Yes, he said, the history of Lebanon is traced in funeral wreaths and coffin shrouds, but never like this. I am angry about what has happened there. But as I continue to try to contact friends, I will temper that anger with prayers and mourning. I've been privileged down the years to have met Brian on a few occasions. Whether chatting to him in his home while enjoying his wife Audrey's freshly baked scones, sharing a platform with him at a book festival, or commissioning him to write in a journalistic capacity in my former newspaper day job, he has never been less than courteous, engaging, deeply perceptive, and, well, funny, very funny. The first time I met him was soon after An Evil Cradling came out, and I had bought the hardback copy as a birthday present for my father. Having established that the best point of contact for Brian was via Matt Malloy's pub in Westport, I sent a letter to ask if I could meet him so that he could sign the book. About a week later he rang me, and we arranged to meet in a pub in Dunleary. And so it was that early one evening we sat side by side at the bar, he signed the book, and then we talked about how he was doing. When he took his leave of me after about an hour, I opened the book to look at his signature. And I laughed out loud. "For Jim," he'd written. "Best wishes from Brian Keenan. I hope you enjoy it more than I did." Happy homecoming, Brian, 30 years on. Let freedom ring.
I have no idea where the time went, not the foggiest notion. But it's been 50 years since I first stepped into the arts block in Belfield, a rookie in this new world of third level education. Coming from a school where the total student population was less than 100, this teeming building and teeming campus in a teeming city was a shock to me. All these people hurrying about their business, and all of them, it seemed, knowing where they were bound and what they were doing, and worse still, all of them seeming to have lots of friends. It took me a month or two to find my feet. Foolishly, perhaps, I spent the first couple of weekends in Dublin wandering the city, hanging out at the Dandelion Market, waiting for the miracle of human connection to manifest itself. It didn't, at least not in those first few weeks. But little by little, I got to know people in my English and history and philosophy classes. Faces gradually became familiar, names were exchanged, and lunches were eaten in company rather than alone. I joined a couple of societies, and in one of these, I met the smiling Stephen Hilliard. Stephen was 5 years older than me, and he had a life and experience far beyond the confines of my sheltered secondary schooling. He'd worked as a street sweeper in London. He was an Irish-speaking member of the Church of Ireland. He was deeply interested in Christianity and socialism, He had a part-time job in the Irish Times as a sub-editor and sometime reporter on religious affairs. He had a speech impediment. He had a wonderful warmth about him, and most importantly for those of us who knew him and were constantly penniless, he had a Morris Minor and was a generous chauffeur. It's difficult at this remove to realise how great it was to have motorised transport in Dublin in the early 70s. I had a bicycle donated to my college career by our neighbour Mrs O'Connell. Otherwise, transport was by Shanks Mare or on the open-backed platform of the 46A or the 10, always with an eye out for the bus conductor. A trip into the city centre from Belfield might involve three buses with lightning-quick exits, often while the bus was still moving as the conductor went up or down the stairs in search of fares. So, having Stephen as a friend not only opened a new world of debate and discussion on republicanism and fun, but it also provided regular transport to and from political meetings and events in the city centre. With four or five or six of us crammed into the Morris Minor, the journeys were educational trips in the truest sense of that phrase. Stephen was studying Irish, English and history, and he never failed to provide copies of lecture notes for those of us who were otherwise engaged. In my case, playing endless World Cup matches on the back pitches in Belfield, while lectures were proceeding without me in the arts block. Stephen moved away from Belfield in 1973, while I remained there to do my HDIP in education. Our paths crossed occasionally, and I knew that he had gone on to study theology, and some years later been ordained into the Church of Ireland. This was no great surprise. He had often spoken about his uncle, Bob Hilliard, who was not only a champion boxer and Church of Ireland rector, but who had gone to London, joined the Communist Party, and volunteered to fight in the Spanish Civil War, dying in February 1937 as a result of wounds received at the Battle of Jarama. When he spoke about his uncle, it was clear where Stephen's Christian, socialist and radical roots lay. And so, as often happens, a friendship that had blossomed in college became an occasional crossing of paths. I knew Stephen was working as a priest somewhere in Dublin, and from time to time I'd meet someone who knew him and I'd send my best wishes. And then, 20 years after we'd met, and 30 years ago, I heard Stephen's name on a news report. He had just moved to Rathdrum in County Wicklow as rector. There had been a break-in at the rectory, and he had been killed. Even now, it's hard to believe, to accept that a man so filled with goodness and kindness and laughter could have been cut down so early in his life. When I remember him, I remember a laughing man, crouched over the steering wheel of the old Morris Minor, while we piled in behind him, ready for another trip, another lesson in life, another moment in a fleeting but wonderful friendship.
When you're down and trouble, and you need a helping hand, and nothing, oh, nothing is going right. Close your eyes and think of me.
Flown the coop. The key to survival in these turbulent times, you tell your rest of heart, is to no longer long for faraway places or dream of a bookshop in a gallery in Berlin where you promised yourself you would return. No, you say, settle for home, for the small pleasures of the small spaces of your back garden. Enjoy the chittering of birds in the dream time of your modest enclosure in the suburbs. Listen to your breathing body and the steady pulsing of your heart. And warming to your theme, you declare, learn from the contentment of the goldfinch in its cage. But your impatient heart has stopped listening a long time ago and has already flown the coop. So you follow her to the old estate where you like to walk and sit on a bench dedicated to the memory of Joe, who invites you to sit a while and smile back at nature. And you do take time to take in the view of the mountain, Quill na Fishoiga, the wood of the lark, and the white clouds in their high sky, sipping the coffee you bought from the young Hungarian man in the coffee shop, where you embarrassed yourself, naming every Magyar writer you could remember in your foolish eagerness to make a connection, as he handed you your flat white and prepared to serve his next customer. And now you wonder what inscription your family will have inscribed on a seat for you when your immortal soul has flown its corporeal coop. And you attribute the sudden quickening of your heart to the strength of the coffee as a swan rises from the lake, and you are startled by the clamour of her wings and the hundreds of starlings circling overhead.
At the top of the stairs to the first floor was a mannequin in a glass case wearing Willie Pierce's rebel uniform. In Western Row Christian Brothers School, it was difficult not to be reminded of the 1916 rebellion. The Pierce brothers were past pupils. But the streets around us bore traces of other heroes, international literary geniuses among them. Across the road from us was Trinity College. Further up Western Row was Oscar Wilde's birthplace, and just around the corner his family's later home, No. 1 Merrion Square. Further on again was Oliver St. John Gogarty's house in Ely Place, opposite where George Moore had lived. Samuel Beckett had worked in his father's quantity surveyor's office around the corner in Leinster Street, opposite the old Green's bookshop. Up at Stephen's Green were numbers 85 and 86, home to the Jesuit poet Gerard Manley Hopkins. I remember learning Hopkins' poetry at school, but I don't remember hearing much about our school's other ghostly neighbours, literary or otherwise, except, of course, the Pierce and Sons' monumental sculpture business nearby on what used to be Great Brunswick Street, now Pierce Street. I've often wondered, was Pierce thinking of his old alma mater when he described the education system of his time as the murder machine? He had by then founded St. Enda's School in Rathfarnham, which equaled our school in its republican fervour, but was a world away from our daily dose of rote learning from teachers who are often impatient and frustrated. In his pamphlet, The Murder Machine, published in January 1916, Pierce describes the education system of his time as cold and mechanical, like the ruthlessness of an immensely powerful engine, a machine vast, complicated, with a multitude of far-reaching arms, with many ponderous presses carrying out mysterious and long-drawn processes of shaping and moulding. In contrast, he writes, when we were starting St. Enda's, I said to my boys, we must recreate and perpetuate in Ireland the knightly traditions of Cuchulainn. Better is short life with honour than long life with dishonour. I care not though I were to live but one day and one night, if only my fame and my deeds live after me, the noble traditions of the Fianna. At Western Row CBS, we did have an inspirational English teacher. He stuck mostly to the curriculum, and there were no class outings to local places of literary significance. But Brother Gilmore did organise a film showing of Laurence Olivier's version of Hamlet with Elsinore beetling o'er its base into the sea. But maybe he was right not to expose us to too much culture, as some of our merry crew laughed and sniggered at the men in tights and the many codpieces on show in the film. Brother Gilmore thundered from the back row with just one word, savages. We were in fifth year when up went Nelson and the Pillar Too, as the song went at the time. Walking through the rubble next day at lunch hour, I missed out on finding Nelson's head. Somebody had got there before me. In those days, my friend Alex and I were often to be found at lunch hour in an Abbey Street basement where we played snooker with a slightly disreputable crowd. I wonder now what they thought of us lunch hour schoolboys piling into that smoke-filled room. Our parents naturally had no idea where we went in the middle of the day. We were, to an extent, following Pierce's educational philosophy. If a boy shows an aptitude for doing anything better than most people, he quotes a colleague approvingly in that pamphlet, he should be encouraged to do that and to do it as well as possible. I don't care what it is, hopscotch, if you like. There was a wider wild world on show just up the street at the Natural History Museum, otherwise known to us at the time as the Animal Museum. In the grassy area at the entrance, there's a bronze statue of Thomas Heasel Park, which was as interesting to us teenage boys as anything in the museum. Park, from Kilmore, County Roscommon, a surgeon with the British Army, had been out in Africa. A bronze plaque beside the statue depicts Park sucking the poison from an arrow wound in the chest of his co-expeditionary Captain Stairs to save his life. What more adventure could you want at our age? He became the first Irishman to cross the African continent from coast to coast and was reputedly one of the first European explorers to see the mountains of the moon, the fabled source of the Nile. Park died in Scotland in 1893, aged only 36. All our heroes at that time seemed to die young. We heard nothing about Park in school, but I can still name from memory the seven rivers that flow into the Wash on the east coast of England, or list, in Irish, the main goods produced in Holland. My friend Alex became a really good snooker player, and I became expert, at least, in chalking a cue and setting up the table, as we followed our informal education in the smoky snooker dens of Dublin, as prescribed by Porrick Pierce.
We had to preface the little song that we sang about Nelson, and we were looking through some books of poetry, Irish poetry, and we came across a poem by Louis MacNeice, poet and, as it turns out, prophet. A poem called Dublin, just simply Dublin, and this is the first verse of the poem. Is that recorded, Nat? Grey brick upon brick. Declamatory bronze on sombre pedestals. O'Connell, Grattan, Nore. And brewery tugs and swans on the balustraded stream. And the bare bones of a fanlight over a hungry door. And a soft wind on the cheek. And porter from the taps with heads of yellow cream. And Nelson on his pillar, watching his world collapse.
Receiving exam results. My mother's left the letter on the windowsill of the hall, full of August light. She's made herself scarce, but is present. The envelope is utility bill beige. I pick it up and feel, even at this moment, the fates are changing their minds, as if the future is still fluid, as if they are magically rewriting what's inside. A B and three C's, an A and a D. And that only when I slit it will they stop. I tear the paper, take out the paper, and bring myself to look and look away from words rushing to reform themselves into what's irrevocably engraved.
On this morning's programme, we heard The Leaving Results by Norma McMaster, Let Freedom Ring by Rosalind Dee, Stephen by James McKenna, Flown the Coop, a poem by Kevin McDermott, Cumberland Academy Literary Greatness and Pierce's Murder Machine by Frank Kavanagh, and Receiving Exam Results, a poem by James Harper. The music this morning was The Glory Reel and the Heathery Church by Alton, Dance of Maria by Elias Labany, You've Got a Friend by James Taylor, All Our Troubles Have Flown Away by Gavin Friday and Morris Caesar, and Farewell to Nelson by the Dubliners. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy. For more from this and other RTE culture programmes, please see rte.ie/culture.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.